Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Happy Valentine's Day, Change Surfers. Have you ever imagined that you had larger breasts, larger muscles, ever wanted to have modify your body in some way to increase your erotic potential or the pleasure that you can have erotically? Well, this is one of the major interests that I have in terms of body modifications in the future, because usually what I talk about are things like greater health, longevity, greater intelligence, those kinds of modifications. But certainly there are a lot of other desires that people have, a lot of other potentials they would like to actuate in their lives. This question has led me to Catherine Gates. She's the author of Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex, and the founder and publisher of Gates of Heck Press. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I notice in your background here that you have a BFA in sculpture and that you ran a art theater, and so you're really coming out of the critical arts discourse and background.
Yeah, that and anthropology, which is what I have my BA in, so I guess I'm from all over the map. But what interests me is images and how people use them and how images use people.
Uh-huh. So this book that you wrote called Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex, it's a catalog of and an attempt to systematize a little bit, think about the different kinds of sexual fetishes that exist out there. How did you get interested in the topic? We'll start off with the usual question.
Well, I've always been interested in the fringe, and I guess, you know, like I think a lot of people grow up thinking they're a freak for whatever they're thinking about during, you know, fantasies. And I really thought I was a freak. Of course, now I think I know a lot better that I'm really actually kind of normal compared to a lot of the people that I've talked to. and in a way, they're all normal too. But my attraction is to sort of, you know, the human imagination and how far it can take us. And since I love sex, it makes sense for me to be interested in the sexual imagination.
You've been working on a degree, actually, from the Institute of Advanced Studies of Human Sexuality in San Francisco. Is that are you out in San Francisco now, or?
No, I just have to go out there once a semester.
I see. Okay, so how did you do research for this book?
Well, it started with, I mean, I actually started the book, I guess, way back in like 1995 or so. Officially, I started it, but I'd been collecting sort of odd homemade desktop publishing magazines that started to coming out in the late 80s and early 90s, sort of during the desktop publishing revolution, when anyone with a computer and a printer could turn out their own magazine devoted to their own, you know, obscure little interest. And of course, you know, one of the first things that people seem to do is publish magazines devoted to their obscure little interest in something erotic. And so in the Lower East Side of New York, there's a great store that started turning me on to all of these things, like, you know, a magazine devoted to bald women, or a magazine devoted to hairy women, or a magazine devoted to pony girls. And so these all started cropping up, and I started collecting them. And then, of course, the web really, you know, hit hard in the early 90s. And I was online pretty much, you know, from the beginning there, looking at stuff like this. So I did a lot of finding people through the magazines and through the web and interviewing them by phone and going to parties and meeting people in person, and I did all sorts of stuff.
There's a pony play you mentioned just a second ago. Pony play turns out to be one of the more common ones, just trawling through all the web porn that's available, and there seems to be a lot of pictures of people engaging in being ponies,
mm-hmm.
which is actually what led to this, my wanting to do this interview in the first place. But,
uh-huh.
but tell us a little bit about the pony play subculture, and you say it's the Aristotelian fetish?
Well, it was called the Aristotelian fetish sort of back in the late Victorian era, when sort of psychoanalysis started. It wasn't called that then, obviously, but, you know, they would start cataloging perversions. And it was called the Aristotelian perversion because there is, you know, the philosopher Aristotle in ancient Greece was said to have given his wife ponyback rides. And, you know, it was interpreted as being a sexual act, I think this might have been some kind of, you know, libel from his enemies back then, who knows. But so it was called that for that reason. And but it's been around for a really long time.
Well, one of the things that led to this interview was that I'm involved in the transhumanist subculture and folks who want to modify their bodies in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I saw this website for folks who had fantasies, not just sexual, but kind of life fantasies about becoming horses, being horses,
mm-hmm.
unicorns, and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
And in your website, you have a graph that kind of illuminates and connects that particular set of fantasies, those kind of transformation fantasies,
mm-hmm.
to a lot of other things. Is pony play is not necessarily a transformation fantasy?
Well, I mean, it's an imaginative play-acting transformation, but not necessarily a medical one.
Right.
So you know, there are always these sort of thrilling rumors that go through these communities about somebody who went all the way, you know, who lives 24/7 as a pony and, you know, had their, Achilles tendons cut so they can't stand up and all these sort of wacky things. But I think those are really just these sort of thrilling mythologies that people create for themselves. I don't particularly think there are too many people out there doing that.
Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of overlap with the body morph, body modification subcultures, because in some sense, the tattooing, piercing, tongue splitting, all of that has an erotic aspect to it.
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm.
And did you look at much of that?
Well, not really, not in this book. I mean, the main actual physical transformation stuff I dealt with in the book was weight gain.
You call that body inflation?
No, there's actually a chapter on feeders, fat admirers,
and
feeders.
Feeders and feedees, right?
Yeah, those are people who get into a relationship where the partner encourages them to gain large amounts of weight, and then the transformation of the body becomes a kind of focus in the relationship, erotic and otherwise.
Well, how's that different from body inflation?
Well, body inflation is primarily a fantasy thing. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I dealt with, you know, 95% of the people are perfectly interested in keeping these things completely in the fantasy realm and have absolutely no interest in the sort of reality of it. In fact, the idea of kind of getting involved in the medical stuff and anything that would actually hurt is really unpleasant to them. So it's easier for them to keep it in fantasy and keep it on this level of magic, which is very exciting for them. You know,
so they write stories about it and do art about it and things like that.
Right. Or you know, say maybe the body inflation people might buy an inflatable rubber suit or something. But it's not really their bodies. It's not like the people who, you know, inject saline solution into their bodies to create inflated areas or whatever. That's a very, very different thing in a way. I mean, I think they see what each other are doing is connected, but it seems to me that in the communities that I've dealt with, it's really people who keep it mostly in the sort of play acting, you know, fun, silly, lighthearted way.
I'm assuming with Catherine Gates, she's the author of Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex, and she's the manager of the Gates of Heck Press. And so the body inflation, people who imagine that they're, or like to think about other lovers with enormous breasts, enormous bellies, butts, things like that, that's,
mm-hmm.
that's the nature of that particular fantasy.
Right, or they imagine themselves inflating. I think, you know, because, you know, in sort of dominance and submission scenarios, there are usually a lot more submissives than there are dominants. And they're, you know, the sort of one of the appeals of the submissive is that it's all about what happens to them. You know, it's all about me. I'm the focus. It's my body that's having things done to it and doing things, you know, strange. And so most of the people who have these sorts of fantasies about things like inflation and stuff fantasize about their own bodies doing these transformations. And it's because, really, you know, when you're sexually aroused, your own body is transforming and is often inflating in interesting areas. And so there's this connection between real body transformations that occur, say, during puberty or during arousal, and the sort of more metaphorical, magical style of these fantasies.
Which kind of connects to the question that you ask in your site, what's the most common fetish? So
mm-hmm.
what's the answer to that? What is the most
common fetish?
The foot fetish.
Yeah.
And why do you think the foot fetish is the most common?
Well, I think that, you know...
Actually, I thought your answer was hair. I'm not a good student yet of the fetishes, but hair would seem to have a connection to the to adolescence and the whole trans body transformation. But foots, I don't see any connection there.
Well, I think the foot fetish actually has to do with the fact that the odors of feet, the smells that come from feet, are probably, you know, wired into us. The feet have these apocrine sweat glands, which are also located in the genital region and in your armpits next to the breasts. And so these very may well have been in our sort of ancient pre-human ancestors a way of leaving scent trails where we walk and stuff and letting people know that we're sexually available or whatever. So, I mean, I think there's a very hardwired reason why feet might be a fetish.
That kind of raises a question. Do you think that some of these fetishes have, I think most people's impression of fetishes is that there's some kind of disorder of the modern mind.
And
that we used to have a more naturalistic sense of sexuality. But Foucault kind of suggests that we used to be more polymorphously perverse and we just have names for things now. So which end do you come out on?
I think that we're polymorphously perverse, yes. I mean, I think that because of the way our brains work and our bodies work, I think that the brain, the imagination, the metaphors, the stories, the fantasies, the dreams play a huge role in sexuality. It's not just two sets of genitalia banging at each other. You know, it's the brain gets involved, you know, and that's a wonderful thing. I mean, you know, human creativity is all about these fantasies of fulfillment and transformation, and that sex should be a part of it seems only natural to me.
There's a lot of concern, obviously, among lay people and I'm sure among psychologists about the edge between what's acceptable fantasy play and what's psychopathology.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that you talk about, like people who become morbidly obese as a part of a sexual fantasy, or certainly people who, now that there's been this brouhaha about the cannibalistic subculture in Germany and people who want to be eaten and so forth, which is a fantasy that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
You know, do you think that some of these fantasies can lead to self-destructive behavior and are actually manifestations of some kind of psychopathology, or is there a line to be drawn?
Well, you know, I mean, I go by the SM credo, safe, sane, and consensual. Of course, what's safe, what's sane, and what's consensual are areas that are worth discussing and sort of hammering out. But, I mean, you know, I also have to say that I find the sort of persistent medicalization of normality to be a real troublesome aspect of our culture. You know, this idea that if you don't do what's defined as normal, something's got to be wrong with you and you ought to be, you know, there's something dangerous about you. And I think that certainly people can do things that are very self-destructive, but somehow when sex is involved, people get far more worried about it. I mean, you know, I know people who do, you know, crazy things like, you know, hang gliding or climbing mountains and things like that, but somehow that's considered to be, you know, noble, whereas, you know, doing something that's a little bit edgy that has any kind of sex involved is considered to be naturally crazy.
Have you seen the movie Secretary?
No.
Secretary's recent film out, and I forget the name of the director, but has Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Spader as a woman secretary and a boss, a lawyer, who have an S&M relationship. And the director says that he wanted it to be the My Beautiful Laundrette for the S&M subculture, the kind of the normalization of S&M. Do you think that there is this trajectory that the gay and lesbian movement sexual liberation movements in general have begun to validate and open people up to the idea that they can have a more, that some of these things that they thought were psychopathological can now be in the normal domain?
Well, I mean, and then you have these tremendous backlashes from, you know, people all over the country. I mean, I think it seems to some people like it's sort of, you know, what next, you know, animals and kids. You know, this sense that somehow if you permit people to do certain things that there's no end in sight kind of idea. I mean, I think there is a normalization of SM, at least with the sort of fashion vocabulary of SM, the clothing and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure that the mainstream is quite aware of the level of negotiation and the complexity of consent that goes on within the serious SM community. I mean, I did read about that film, and what gave me pause about it was, of course, the fact that there is a real power discrepancy between the people who are playing. And that's tricky. You know, I mean, you know, SM play is ideally between people who are actually functionally equal economically and politically in a society in which, you know, there are real freedoms. To suggest that, for example, you know, a relationship between a man and a woman in a misogynistic, you know, Muslim-oriented country could be a consensual SM relationship is very questionable to me. You know, the relationship between a boss and an employee is troublesome, worrisome. I don't think that's an ideal SM scenario.
You raised the same question, though, about the feedees and feeders, the notion mm-hmm. of men cultivating women's bodies as if they were some kind of erotic sex toy or blow-up doll.
Right, or even agricultural. I mean, there are these sort of agricultural metaphors that the feeders and feedees use. It's almost as if this is like, you know, they're feeding a pig, you know. Yes, I think it's worrisome. I mean, it's always good to be worried and to be aware and alert, but not to automatically dismiss things. Because, you know, I started off the project being really freaked out about a lot of this stuff because I didn't know the people, you know. I mean, I didn't know what people were really doing and what they were like, and I wasn't, you know, any kind of player of my own. I mean, I've had wild fantasies, but I've never really had much of the guts to actually act on stuff. And so, like most sort of relatively ordinary people, I figured, well, gosh, I mean, the people who are actually, like, going out and doing these things, they must be nuts, you know? And I have to tell you, I mean, the people that I met were, you know, every single one of them really, really sane, you know? I mean, they were very, you know, reasonable about these limits that they were setting themselves. And they did set limits. They said, you know, oh, I'll never go over 300 pounds because at that point, I feel that with my frame and, you know, my genetic history, that would be a real problem for me and I would, you know, I would cease to be mobile. But in the fantasy realm, I'd like to go up to 1,000, but I'll never go over 300 in reality. You know, and so I think the people were really sort of negotiating the line between fantasy and reality in a very rational way. I mean, there are people who I've heard about in that scene who did not observe their own limits. And, you know, you worry. You worry. But I think that you have to give people the benefit of the doubt rather than sort of shut down and assume that anybody who has a fantasy about something is actually going to go out and, you know, do it without observing any sort of reasonable limits.
This is Dr. J. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. We're speaking with Catherine Gates. She's the author of Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex, and she's the founder and publisher of Gates of Heck Press, and you can find her on the web. Catherine, you say on your website that you have that you yourself have a fetish, though, and you're not a complete naif about some of these things because you have a gun fetish. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? In your case, what does a gun fetish entail? And can you speak more broadly about people who have a gun fetish? Because in some sense, you know, like if you see Michael Moore's recent movie about American culture, in some sense, the whole country has a gun fetish.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when I say I have a gun fetish, I use the term in more of the kind of sloppy street way of using the term. I mean, you know, the sort of medical industry would have you think that the term fetish is only applicable to someone who is unable to achieve sexual arousal or orgasm without the object, you know, and that it's only people who have what I would call a hardcore fetish. Whereas I use the term in a very lightweight way in that handling and shooting guns gets me excited. But since I live in New York State now and not in Virginia, I don't own any anymore, so And I still have a perfectly wonderful sex life. So for me, it was mostly the thrill, danger, sense of, well, you know, I think it's the fear for me, and I think a lot of fetishes have to do with fear and a sense of aliveness you get from going through something that's frightening. You know, we have a fight or flight mechanism, and I suspect that somewhere in there, there's a third F. It's also a four-letter word that's like a sex word. In other words, that you get these kind of stimuli that really get your blood boiling, get you afraid, get you terrified, and yet you walk through it and you survive this thing. It's like instantaneously there's a sexual component to it. I mean, that's why, you know, 9 months after earthquakes, all these, you know, there's a baby boom. I think that people seem to have this tendency to find fear and excitement and those kind of thrills very arousing, and on a sexual level too. And I think that's what it is for me. I mean, I'm afraid of guns. I respect them greatly, and I think they are terrifying things. I mean, they explode, you know. I mean, they're phallic. They explode, but yet I can master them, and I can use them well, and I can be the master of this object, and therefore that gives me a great sense of empowerment, and that's exciting.
I think what you're getting at there actually touches on one of the common critiques that I hear, especially from the Christian right, mm-hmm. about pornography in general and sexual deviation in general, that they have a kind of gateway theory of it, that once you get a taste for attaching transgression and the arousal of doing dangerous things with your sexuality, that then you get acclimated to whatever you're doing and you need to move on to the next more dangerous, more transgressive act, and eventually you're going to get into territory which is destructive to yourself, others, and you know, illegal maybe.
Well, and, you know, I think there are people who are like that. I mean, I think there are people who keep having to push the buttons harder and harder and farther and farther. But I don't think that's the general rule. I mean, I think that there are plenty of people out there for whom they've had a fetish all, you know, their entire lives for balloons and popping balloons, and maybe they'll go through phases where they have to pop more balloons than usual, but then they'll just go back to popping one or two. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that...
Well, this is one of the fetishes that I had never heard of until uh-huh. I read you what you had written about it. I mean, speak about that. Is it a variation on a latex theme that people feel the balloon as a sensual object? But what's the popping have to do with it? I mean,
well, I think it's definitely a subset of the latex fetish, except that the balloon people grow up having absolutely no awareness that, you know, they're not interested in rubber clothing because it doesn't inflate. You know, for them, it's this sort of magical growth of the thing and the increasing tension and anxiety about when is it going to pop, and then the sort of release of anxiety and tension when it does pop that constitutes the sort of core sexual metaphor of the balloon. You know, it's like, a penis. It grows and gets bigger and bigger and bigger and harder, and then you don't know when it's going to pop, and you don't know if you're going to be able to control when it's going to pop, and then blammo, it goes off. And I think that's basically what it's all about for the balloon people. But I think that the smell of latex is certainly one of the elements. It makes balloons interesting in the first place. Excuse me.
Well, speaking of coughing, you mentioned that coughing's another fetish.
Yes. Coughing, sneezing.
And those are related to the fact that expectoration or getting things out of your body is connected for people with sex? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's usually a kind of a simplistic connection between a lot of fetishes and body parts and things that bodies do during sex, sexual smells. You know, there's usually a very simple connection on one level between fetishes and sex. It's almost too obvious, you know. I mean, sometimes when it's pointed out to people who have the fetish, they're like, oh, really? Oh, they're sort of disappointed. But
let me take you, we only have a couple minutes left. Let mm-hmm. me take you back to the metabods and the boitars.
Okay.
Because, again, my core interest in this as a bioethicist and a campaigner for people's rights to body transformation is that... it's intriguing to me that people may embark in the future on body transformations, profound body transformations, not for the reasons that most of my colleagues imagine, which is to be healthier, to be smarter, to have more abilities, but for these erotic reasons, which in some cases may even, you know, reduce their health and their abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that there's a heck of a lot more people out there who have, or at least having fantasies about body transformation in erotic ways than are currently having fantasies about some of these other things. So, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that there is a market for people who would? You say it's maybe only 5%, but you think that there are people who would use new medical technologies in these eroticized ways?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if your interest is simply erotic and not on a number of other levels. I mean, and I think the erotic encompasses a lot of things that people don't appreciate, you know, that the erotic can also encompass a kind of spiritual element for people, that the fetish has a meaning other than simply orgasm, you know. But I think that, you know, how far would anyone go to just get off? I mean, I think that there's a very limited number of people for whom, if it was simply a means of getting off, would they really go through all of this trouble.
But it's usually much more. It's about their life and their self-concept and all of
right,
that.
Self-image. I mean, I think, for example, you know, there's a whole community of people called furries for whom this idea of human-animal anthropomorphism and transformation is really kind of a core of their identity. I mean, they go to, you know, conventions to be with other furries, to pretend to be these kind of creatures, and it's a kind of totem relationship to the animal. It's a kind of fandom, you know, it's a sort of pop culture fandom, but it's also often a much more kind of shamanistic idea about animals. And I mean, I think for people like that, you know, the concept of maybe possibly getting, you know, a mane created on their backs and necks or whatever wouldn't be too unappealing. You know, it might be kind of cool if you could have a real life and do that too.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Catherine Gates. She's the author of Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex, and she's also the founder and publisher of Gates of Heck Press, and she has a very entertaining website. Is it CatherineGates.com?
No, it's DeviantDesires.com.
DeviantDesires.com.
All one word.
Right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.